Hello and welcome to episode 153 of The Great and Crowbar. This is the 18th of August 2016. My name is Chris Thurston. Tonight I am joined by Philippa Waugh.
Hello.
And Tom Senior.
Hello.
It's the week of Gamescom, also known as German Hell, if you work in the industry. And it's been a surprisingly quiet year, because, I mean, it's also known as the European E3, which is the other thing people call it.
I've never heard anyone called it German Hell.
That also Sausage Heaven.
Oh.
It's both at once. It's kind of a Blakeian nightmare of
sweat.
Bratwurst and sweaty teenagers.
Well.
Yeah, it's horrible. If you have to cover it as a professional, really.
It is, yeah. But normally at least it's a font of game announcements and news and stuff that wasn't quite ready for E3 and slipped down the ticket a bit. Whereas this year, it doesn't seem to have been.
You wouldn't really notice it was on, would you?
No, I didn't, really.
Yeah, it's just passed by. Obviously none of us are out there, but even, you know, I mean, our colleagues are seeing things, but they're things we already know about. It's nothing new.
There's a few trailers that were embargoed until particular times, but...
Yeah. It's just like a limp effort, wasn't it, from the industry, really? Well, have a few embargoed trailers, but that's it, really. No new announcements, apart from... Go for it.
You're going to say Resident Evil?
Yes.
Okay, let's go with Resident Evil first, because I was going to talk about a game that looks like Resident Evil.
Oh, no, I'm thinking of a different thing. I've mixed my words up. Go ahead.
Okay, because it's funny you should say Resident Evil, because what you meant was Metal Gear.
That's correct.
But honestly, what's happened? So did they.
You can see how the two influences have merged in my mind now.
So one of the games that was announced that makes for a newsworthy snippet is Metal Gear Survive, the big V, indicating its connection to Metal Gear The Phantom Vein. And it's... the people on the internet are enormously cross, but that's not new. The specific reason they're cross is because it is a four-player co-op action game that very much looks like it's a zombie shooter. And actually, the thing it resembles most, at least from the trailer, is something like Resident Evil Mercenaries, which was the sort of score attack version of Resident Evil. Sam from PC Gamer spoke to Konami's marketing person today, I think, about it. And he was a bit vague. Asked if it was going to be a stealth game, which is what everyone would assume it would be. His answer was, well, when you think about Metal Gear, you think about stealth, don't you? And then didn't say a lot more on the topic other than there will be stealth in it. There's a cardboard box in the trailer. But it's very unclear what form that would take, because the premise is that, brief spoilers for Ground Zeroes, or the very, very beginning of Phantom Pain. But when Mother Base was destroyed, which is the big oil rig that Solid Snake lives on with his friends, Naked Snake lives on with his friends, when that was destroyed, it didn't just sink into the sea, like you might have previously been led to believe. It was actually pulled into a wormhole, and scant survivors now live in a wasteland on the ruins of Mother Base.
Have they watched Pacific Rim? Is that what this is?
It's not even that kind of a wormhole, because instead of a big monster coming out, they've fallen into a crystal zombie dimension where they must fight crystal zombies with spears and bows and guns.
If you're reaching around for something quick to do with a Metal Gear license that you could turn around relatively
quickly. It's not the obvious thing, is it?
Quickly, and you decided to come up with the idea for the game on the back of an envelope in about 5 minutes, this might be the game that happened.
Maybe, but like... I think it actually takes quite a bit of effort to go so left field with it.
Yeah, like, so strange.
They could have done, like, Solid Snake cooking Mama.
They could have done. Yeah, it could be weirder, that's for sure. But, I mean, people have a pretty firm idea of what... Well, this is the sort of interesting thing about it, because the trailer doesn't really give very much away. But people have a pretty firm idea of what Metal Gear is, even though every game has changed that idea substantially. And so people who are positive about this game... are saying, well, everyone knows what Metal Gear is, so surely this is that, but with co-op, which the trailer doesn't really suggest. The trailer suggests that it's a zombie fighting game. And people who know what Metal Gear is are also saying, the angry ones, this is clearly not that, therefore what the fuck are they doing? And I admit, the first time I saw the trailer, without being aware of the kind of now pretty tiresome internet backlash, my first thought was, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, I mean, it's nonsense, but... It's interesting to consider, like, it's nonsense in a way that Metal Gear fans can't accept. And that's quite a high, they're very resistant to nonsense.
That is, yeah.
So it's...
Well, take a magic dog that can kidnap people.
a magic doctor has his own knife that he kind of unsheaths and stabs people with.
We'll take a pink helicopter coming to extract a man who's riding around on a two-legged robo Segway blaring like Maneater.
Yeah.
We'll take that. That's fine.
It's an amazing, amazing universe. But I think, was there anything they could have shown that would have resulted in a positive internet response? Because without Kojima, that kind of celeb thing.
Like, I think people, I don't know, I think there's always going to be a backlash. But I think if it had been like, we're making a Metal Gear game here, it's like another Ground Zeroes. We're going to make a big sandbox stealth thing for you to infiltrate. Mm. And you're going to play as a side character from one of the other Metal Gear games. We'll fucking pick somebody. Mm. And you can play as them for a game.
Yeah.
Or something. Then I think people would probably go, well, it's not very ambitious, but we accept that.
Yeah.
Whereas it's hard to tell whether this is ambitious, because it is different, but on the same token, it's not like the world has a shortage of four-player co-op zombie survival games.
Mm.
Really?
No, it's true. And what does the Metal Gear kind of thing bring to a four-player zombie co-op?
If you sing into the microphone, the zombies go to sleep.
Yeah. That would be amazing. But it didn't show any of the, like, the heroes it showed weren't the kind of weird heroes that you see in the Metal Gear universe. It's like, here's the person with the bow that is from every other game. And she's got like a weird arrow that has like a twisty blade on the front. But apart from that, you know, these are the most generic kind of characters you could imagine in a Metal Gear.
I thought they might be player created, and that's what they were trying to indicate with the blandness.
Mm.
Because one of them,
it was code all along.
Players are really unimaginative.
Well, like someone tweeted a screenshot of one of the, like, the main dude you see in the trailer, who's literally the blandest looking man alive. Mm.
Yeah.
Like, really is.
Yeah.
And someone, oh, my favourite Metal Gear character, Solid Chet. And it really did. It is just like, it looks like someone's face has been mapped into the game, and they don't really belong there, because there's no sort of, that's not really a design that is unified with a world where everyone's got an eye patch or a beard or something.
Yeah.
So I imagine it's a bit like Metal Gear Online.
Or like maybe that Assassin's Creed multiplayer nonsense that I never really paid any attention to, but looked as unengaging as any of the unengaging Assassin's Creed titles have done, but like, just sort of, it just looked so generic and so kind of, but why would I even want this?
Mm.
And it never really satisfactorily answered that question for me. And it sounds like this is certainly not setting up its stall in a way that is making people go, I really do want this.
It's not the thing people were asking for, that's for sure. And the other thing, they said is it's not going to be a full price game. So maybe this is just their like little testing the water stopgap on the way to whatever they'll do next. Yeah. Honestly, they probably don't need to do something else with that license. They will, because it's very popular.
Couldn't they have just done Metal Gear Go or something?
Hmm. Wrong publisher.
But, I mean,
yeah. But like,
okay, rip off Go. Mm. I don't know. Like,
Kojima tweeted a gif of Snake shooting himself in the head in response to the trailer. Kojima at his, you know, most subtle there.
Nice. Yeah, so, what could it possibly mean?
I don't know. If only we can see inside the mind of Kojima.
Then he tweeted at the Konami account just the word stop. So you can tell how he feels about it.
Yeah. Well, there's literally no information about it. They've dangled out a really generic trailer for something no one, everyone's just guessing at.
Yeah, I think it's more like, it makes for an interesting contrast with the announce of The Phantom Pain, which was done so slowly. Like, the first thing they announced was, like, that there was a game called The Phantom Pain. And it was very ambiguous. But there were holes in the words The Phantom Pain, where if you overlaid the words Metal Gear Solid 5, they fit.
Mm.
And so people figured that out. But then then they released another trailer, which was just words appearing in the gaps in the previous words. And people lost their shit over that.
God.
And that slow build-up to, you know, a new Metal Gear game was such a huge deal. And it does show that some of the spark has gone out of the name when a new thing gets announced and everyone's just like outraged.
Yeah.
It's or just nonplussed as well. It sounds like some of it is.
It sounds like Kojima's taking his slow burn marketing to his new company, where it took him like 6 months to reveal their fucking logo. Remember that?
God, that was amazing though. Like, it's like, I wrote about a logo trailer. But it was just because it was a whale on the moon, really.
It was an astronaut man, but he was underwater, but also on the moon, and there was a whale there.
And
he's also a knight,
don't
forget that.
Oh, of course, yeah.
but I just, yeah.
Everything is two things. He's a knight astronaut on the moon sea with a whale hologram and the spear flag.
But I also feel a bit like maybe this is still part of the Metal Gear Solid 5 advertising campaign.
Yeah.
Like somehow, like maybe he will just be doing that for the rest of his life. Like all games from then on are still just a continuation of the slow burn marketing.
It's, yeah, but that's about the only big thing to have come out of Gamescom.
Yeah, pretty much.
Because the entire world of computer games, I was apart from it for a week, has, mostly been occupied with how it feels about No Man's Sky.
Yeah, it's out finally.
That feels like as good an excuse as any to talk about how we feel about No Man's Sky. Because we've all been playing it.
I feel like, you know, on Trevor and Simon on, like, so, okay, no, this might not work, but there was a BBC comedy duo called Trevor and Simon, and I think they did, like, a chart rating thing or, just a rating section on the show called Hit, Miss, or Maybe, and you had to put your thumb up or down or waggle it in the middle, like they had big, giant, like, fake hands. And I feel like all of those things rolled into one.
Yeah.
That is my opinion on this game, is that it works and then it really doesn't work. And then it sort of half works while tripping itself up.
But maybe feels like too much of a cop out. So you're in a constant state of hit or miss.
It's just this weird flux of like, it's a game that for me just doesn't quite ever come together properly. Like it feels like it's got a lot of constituent parts, and some of them are phenomenal and some of them are clunky as all hell and feel like a bad PC port of a thing, but it never quite coalesces into a single thing. So you keep seeing the game it wants to be, and then you keep seeing the game that it, oh god no. And then yeah,
I think so. I struggled to pin down how I felt about it other than that I liked it. And maybe couldn't figure out how to justify that in a world where everyone was so angry about it. But a few things that I've read recently or seen recently have helped. One of them was an article written by Rob Fearon on his blog about, I'll put all the links to these things in the show notes, just about like the sort of, and also another very good blog on a similar topic by Michael Cook, who is an expert in procedural generation, about the problems with the way we talk about procedural generation and some of the problems that No Man's Sky has given itself that sort of frame some of the criticism it's been receiving. So, I think something that Rob said is like the nature of procedural generation, particularly procedural generation of places on that scale, is that it will have things that are amazing and look handcrafted and are miraculous for having existing by accident. And it will have things that look a bit shit, or things that look a bit shit most of the time, but have one nice thing about it. And when a game has a quintillion planets to explore, it will have all of those things all the time. And that's the sort of, I think the thing that's slightly disingenuous about that joke video that was doing the rounds, where it starts off with the Jurassic Park theme and the original trailer, and then cuts to the launch game to like the kazoo version of the Jurassic Park theme. And it's actually, the game contains both of those things. There are a few things in the launch trailer that I don't think can happen, but I just haven't seen them. I don't know. Mm. Like trees getting knocked out of the way by a big creature. I don't know if that can happen. Maybe it can. Don't know. But actually, it's not miles off what the game is, like when it looks its best.
I think it's more that in the trailer, they can curate that. And, you know, I have no idea, because obviously I wasn't part of any editing process, but so I have no idea the original footage or like how you're allowed to tweak it without it being considered, you know, against the rules or whatever. But I think when you're watching a 1 minute long thing, you see these sort of slices of thing that they want you to see. You know, they, you know, even if it is actual footage, then it takes it, you know, like they might have a million of those journeys that didn't work and that weren't compelling and just ended up being chucked out. Whereas when it's you playing it for 15 hours, you know, straight or over a weekend or whatever, then you encounter a lot of the permutations of the different building blocks that go into things. Like I've seen a lot of animals that look like llamas, but with a weird sort of elongated sphincter neck, and then like just a different head sort of jammed onto the top of that. Mm. And like, after, you know, you see one and you're like, oh God, what a weird creature. You see another one that's a kind of a variation on that rather than a different thing composed of different bits. And you're like, oh, I've started to see the joins. And then you see your third or fourth one and you're kind of like, yep, that's definitely a, a thing that this can fish out of the number box when it wants to generate stuff. And so, but then, you know, I was wandering around this afternoon on a planet that I was exploring, and I came over the crest of a hill and I saw a giant sort of almost like a Chinese dragon worm swimming through the sky.
Wow.
And then sort of as you go over the hill, there's loads of them. Like, there's an actual swarm of these things in the sky, like just flying around like kites. And it was, that was really lovely. And it has those moments as well.
Yeah. I think that's the, so I think, and this is sort of, so some of the backlash to the marketing is like, some of it I think is warranted when things were said and or implied and not even that they weren't delivered, but they weren't sufficiently clarified, which is the more important thing than, because games change in development and people just need to get over that, I think. But the other thing is that, you know, marketing materials, trailers for games often show a carefully curated edit of that game's best things. And that is not news either. And if that's the coals you want to drag No Man's Sky over, then the entire mainstream games industry is culpable.
And also films, and just any, like, everyone understands that trailers show the best bits of the thing, and that you're being shown an ideal facet of the eventual product.
I mean, we've sort of rolled our eyes on this pod before about the, you know, that, that text at the bottom of the screen that says in-engine footage, and you're like, what the hell does that even mean?
I wish that language was a bit clearer. Like, target footage is an understandable statement because it says that this is what we're going to aim for, and we all understand that games development is hard and it might not quite hit this, but this is what we genuinely honestly want to achieve. And that's like an honest statement that people can't really get angry at, whereas pre-alpha footage, they're like, what the hell does that mean? What are people supposed to understand that to be, really?
But I think it's right to say that this particular issue of you know, of setting initial expectations and delivering on them, it exists in an interesting relationship with specifically procedurally generated games.
Yeah, it's true.
Because in, you know, even when people talk about another really tight word, the downgrade stuff, like, often that's taking, you know, Watch Dogs was the original example of this, I think, taking footage from E3 and then comparing it to the launch game, and yet it looks a lot worse because, surprise, surprise, the thing that they were running at E3 was an impossibly souped-up version of the game running on a mega PC. But at least you can sort of compare the actual thing they were showing to its real version and go, this doesn't match up. Whereas in No Man's Sky's case, that's impossible because you can't find the planet that demo footage, the original trailer footage was taken from, if it even exists.
Yeah.
Because the point is, it was probably generated for that trailer. And so you can try and find things that are an approximation of it, but the exact comparison doesn't really exist, which is either grounds to throw out that kind of argument or to kind of keep making it forever, I guess, as the game continuously fails to live up to that specific thing. But the problem with a game that big is you can't say it doesn't contain that.
Yeah. And it never hid the fact that it was procedurally generated, and when they showed it to us and we did previews on it, like Andy's last preview of it, so he described a barren planet that he landed on, and it was all about, you know, well, it was about, look, this is what this game really feels like, and he loves that, and I actually enjoy it, this game, quite a lot, even though I hate most of its systems. I enjoy going down to a planet and pottering around for 15 minutes, and the instant I'm bored, taking off again and finding something else and just landing in different biomes. And I think that a lot of the terrain generation is occasionally spectacular. Like, just before I came out, I found a planet which was just like huge, vast kind of roots coiling through the earth, and just land the ship and look out over this alien horizon. And it truly does feel alien. It has these weird obelisks coming out that you can mine for rare ores and stuff. And that feeling of adventure is what was promised. And I've had received that from the game.
Yeah, same. I think this is, so without being too cute about it, like, that all, the cliche was, you know, what do you do in No Man's Sky, right? And people were asking that over and over again as the game came close to release. As soon as people found out what you do in No Man's Sky, they lost their shit. But actually, I think that question still kind of is open.
Yeah.
Because I really enjoy the game, but I've taken it spectacularly slowly. Yeah. Like, I've played 10 hours of it. I've been to two systems and, like, maybe five planets. Mm. And I spent ages on every single one, just fucking naming everything.
Yeah.
Naming every animal, naming every plant. And it's just turned into, like, the game is this sort of, like, gentle walk writing test thing where it's just, like, can I come up with an evocative name for this thing or this place? And just trying to come up with words that sound cool and sci-fi-ish in relation to each other. And that I, you know, that's just my way of enjoying it. And I'm sort of vaguely goal-oriented and I like upgrading my stuff, but that's a sort of side show to the point, which is taking it mega, mega slowly. Whereas I think if you take it that No Man's Sky is a game about getting the biggest inventory and the best ship as fast as possible, then yeah, it probably isn't very good.
No.
I mean, but yeah.
The crafting stuff is irritating. The inventory stuff I find really irritating. I find most of the actual, when I'm actually engaging with the things it's asking me to do to achieve objectives and it's constantly shouting at you to go here and warp here and do this. Yeah. It's like, just shut up. I'm trying to have a moment on this alien world. Just leave me the hell alone.
It's like that Atlas Pass business. I was kind of like, mate, I'm not interested in your Atlas.
Yeah.
And then about, you know, five nodes of down the activity tree later, it's just like, oh, you know that Atlas Pass thing?
Mm.
Like, it's over here. And you're just like, oh, God. Oh, leave me alone. I didn't want it. I don't care. If those doors are locked, they're fine. They don't want me. I don't want them.
I said yes to the Atlas thing. It doesn't get you an Atlas Pass.
No.
Well, no, but like, you still sort of end up on a big old, like, mission and stuff. And I know that, like, some people are sort of further along the story quests or whatever, however you would describe it in a game like this. And I think, because Adam at work, he's at Gamescom at the moment, but he was just like, oh, there's this, you know, there's a few things that I really want to talk to someone about, but you're all taking such a long time. It was just like, oh, it'll be fine. I'll be up to there when you come back from Gamescom. I won't. I'm taking a million years.
I think I'm stuck at the moment because I need to craft a fuel cell for my hyperdrive in order to launch myself to the next system.
Mm.
But the blueprint doesn't exist in my inventory. And I think you're supposed to receive it as a quest item. I don't think I'm ever going to get that thing.
After a while it kicks in, like you might need to just sort of potter while it figures itself out.
You do get it as a quest item.
Okay. Yeah, like, but I didn't have it for a while and it was like, it suddenly gave me a thing to do that then led me to that. Cause like, I think that's one of its problems and one that I think really doesn't help when you launch a game like this is that it's really bad with teaching new players the systems. It's so haphazard and the tutorial is actually really bad. I'd say it's actively bad in terms of teaching you things that you legit need to know or would benefit from. For example, I was quite far away from my ship and so like all of my, you know, health stuff and whatever else was like ticking down and I was trying to mine the ingredients that I needed to reboot or to, you know, to soup up my life support system in my spacesuit. But then I ran out of mining beam juice and I didn't know what to do. Like, so I tried to get back to the ship as quickly as possible. And, you know, it was quite far away and I was really sort of worried, you know, was I going to make it kind of thing? And then somebody in chat was just kind of like, oh yeah. And I was, you know, basically described a similar situation. And then they were like, it took me forever to work out that I could melee the plants that have the resource that you needed. Exactly. And I was just like, you can watch. And it was just like, the game never tells you that if you run out of juice for your mining beam, just hit a plant.
Hit a plutonium stick.
Exactly. And you're just like, that's so basic. And I nearly died and lost a bunch of progress because you can only save when you get out of your ship. You have to get in and then get out again.
See, like, I think...
Or actually on some waypoints.
Yeah, and whenever you find a waypoint. But like, so... It exists in a kind of a weird place, No Man's Sky, because I think one thing about it is I think it gets actively worse the more game literate you are. Because I think if you're very game literate, you will see the problems with its UI and its progression system that you probably won't if you're dipping into this as someone who only plays games ever so often. And obviously there are things that are going to be frustrations regardless. But I think in order to be able to be so conscious of the efficiencies or not of the things you're doing, you need to be kind of aware of how games traditionally handle this stuff. Which doesn't excuse it necessarily, but it's an interesting problem for it to have because it's sort of got adopted by the hardcore. But actually, I think it's a very, I think it's a strong casual game. It's an algorithm visualizer to be dipped into. The other side to that is I think it would either be, so I think it, there was probably an earlier version of that game where it had no tutorial, no tooltips whatsoever. And I think that version of the game would probably have been better. And I think they probably bolted, I think the reason the tutorial's so bad, this is a guess, but it feels like it's been bolted onto a game that somebody said, this needs a new player experience. Whereas what it would be better off with is, I'm going to argue, no new player experience and the notion that you would rely on other people to teach you the things you need to move forward in kind of a Dark Souls way.
Right.
Where it doesn't explain anything about itself. And the reason for that is because I think fundamentally, like, No Man's Sky is good when it's a game about, like, exploring and sharing information and the things you found with other people. Like, whether that means it could do with a Dark Souls style writing on the ground system wouldn't really work in a game where there's basically almost no chance that two players will ever go to the same place ever. But even if you just rely on social media in or around the game, like, that's probably the version of it I'd prefer to see, where it's almost a genuine mystery. Like, you're just stranded on this planet and you've got to figure out how your ship works and figure out how your stuff works. And
yeah, they kind of have to tell you how to not die. I mean, even Dark Souls just doesn't start draining your health from the outset. Obviously, you run into enemies. True. And the way No Man's Sky does it is that your death is certain within an hour if you don't find plutonium to power up your ship and all that stuff. And you just have to tell people that. And there are other things like upgrading your stuff, removing inventory slots. It's absolute madness. I absolutely hate it. It's a game about collecting stuff all the time. Mm. It's a game about roaming and collecting. And every time you get better at it, you improve your equipment, you decrease your ability to do that, and you have to make shorter and shorter trips. And it's just so counter to what the game is supposed to be about, roaming, and supposed to be able to go as long as far as you like and collect loads of stuff. And just decisions like that just seem crazy to me. That's probably my biggest irritation with the game is that upgrade system. It's better now. I've kind of unlocked a few slots, but every time I make my mining gun faster, I can carry less stuff.
Yeah.
And that's, that makes no fucking sense at all. In any, like, in the gameplay context, or in any sort of context, really. So that's irritating. But at the same time, I do get a kick out of talking to the aliens and going into the space stations, and kind of the races do have their own personality, and they've got their own kind of, when you learn more about them, actually there is quite a bit to them.
I'm enjoying collecting words, actually. There's like little sort of cylinders, mystical cylinders that will teach you bits of vocabulary, which is kind of cool. But there was also, I was going to say, just in response to the idea of not teaching people things, I know that a few people have found, I think Graham perhaps was saying that he'd spawned on a really barren world, and having the game give him some objectives to start with helped him stick with it, because there was nothing to sort of hook him in from the landscape, you know, at that point. And I think he had a run of just sort of the same muddy kind of uninspiring, I guess, landscapes, whereas I had spawned into a kind of pastel coloured like jungle with mysterious caves all over the place. So I think that I hadn't thought of that because I'd had a unique starting experience and was sort of thinking from that point of view. I am wondering how much the need to be on PS4 launch was not exactly a problem, but a problem. And I don't say that as a kind of PC princess kind of thing. It's more that I think this game, more than any other perhaps, was a prime candidate for early access, for them to actually figure out what they wanted those systems to be instead of launch it and sort of try and take it from there. And because I am really enjoying it. on the whole, and I have spent a couple of dozen hours on it by this point, I think, and will spend a lot more. But I would really struggle to recommend someone pay full price for it. And that's a kind of weird feeling. Whereas if it was in early access for 20 quid, I'd be like, yeah, go for it. Go, you know, buy a couple of copies, give one to a mate, you know?
Yeah.
I think like the question of price is a tricky one because like I paid full price for it and, you know, because I'm not covering it for work, so I'm just going to play it. And I've gotten, you know, 10 hours that I've really enjoyed out of it. And I can see the point where I'm likely to get bored.
Mm.
But, you know, that's, you know, by any metric, I've had enough time that I've enjoyed to match up to the price point compared to any other type of game, really. And so, but I sort of agree that it feels like, you know, because what it is a really ambitious, like, exploration sort of experience thing, almost like a toy rather than a game in some ways, made by a studio that had previously only made a stuntman racing game. And I think if it had been allowed to emerge on those terms, the response to it would be a lot easier to pass. But because it had this sort of console destiny and because... And it had all that E3 stage presence. It's never been allowed to be a curio that people discover on their own terms. It had a long time in the center of the spotlight as it got sort of mutated into anything people wanted it to be that it couldn't possibly live up to.
Yeah. And you had like Sean Murray going on like chat shows in America to show this off. It, like it got mainstream breakthrough in a way that a lot of games don't. And I was watching Newsnight last week and they ended with No Man's Sky launch, which is crazy. Wow. Like, yeah, it's just, they just showed footage from the game and it was their outro. So they, like, it's gone outside of our sphere and kind of enthusiast press and it's broken into a different place. And it's one of those weird things where like the studio is not going to stop that from happening because it's amazing. It means fucking loads of sales and loads of publicity, and the more publicity, the better. And, you know, obviously Sony want it to continue. So it's this runaway train that's just, kind of consumed it.
The thing is that I've seen so many hot takes from people who, you know, are from, I guess, our sector of the think space or the online space. But I haven't actually sort of seen what people who maybe watched him on any of those American talk shows would have actually thought, just sort of casually going into, I don't know, a retailer and picking up a copy and going, oh, it's that game that I saw on that thing, it looked cool, I've got a PS4 because I use it for, I don't know, Netflix and Destiny, so here, I mean, I'm just talking about myself now, but I think actually though Destiny is an interesting one because I think I've spoken maybe about this before, certainly to you, Chris, but I went to a seminar on Destiny's UI design at Game Connect in Paris, and it was really interesting because of the amount of time they'd obviously lavished on sort of working out what felt nice to click on, and things like when you move the cursor across the screen, it moves quite fast until it hits a button that you might want to click on, and then it slows down, almost kind of like there's a gravity well there. And so it's just tiny things like that that actually really suit a controller because of that sort of lack of precision, I guess, as compared with a mouse. And so I've actually been playing No Man's Sky on a gamepad on my PC, and I really miss those kinds of things. It's so kind of it's such a huge contrast, and like it even does that thing of, so in Destiny, when you hold to, like, when you hold down a button to activate a prompt, it's because, you know, like, for some of the options, it takes a lot longer than others. For example, if you're disassembling one of the really rare loot drops or something, and it's so that you don't do it by accident. And so you can, it was their version of an, are you sure? Because you can back out at any time, and it's a long time if it's a thing you might really regret. And so it makes sense in those areas. But with No Man's Sky, it's like, I have to press and hold down if I want to toggle an option in the graphics menu, or I have to press and hold down to do this, that and the other if I want to select something. Like I thought, oh, I guess all of the planets have the same weather. And it was because I'd just been going down clicking on them, to select them, instead of the extra 1.5 seconds or whatever it is of just holding on to the thing so that you can skim down the menu. So it's little things like that that do, because I'm familiar with other systems that do it far better, perhaps, to take on your point, Chris, about maybe
literacy.
The more well versed you are, the worse it is. But so it is things like that that do find their way. It's like sand in your bathing suit,
I'd be really interested to hear from anyone or anyone know someone who doesn't play games much, maybe a couple of games a year.
Yeah.
Who has played this, maybe off the back of seeing it get so much press beyond the games industry, because I do think it's in a rare set of games that I think make for quite good ambassadors for what games can be and do, because technologically it's spectacular and there's a cool thing of saying, look, you've got this cool alien planet to explore and oh, guess what? This was all generated by a computer and there's a billion planets like this in this game you can go and explore. And I think if you take away a lot of those concerns about longevity and the critical path and gameplay loops and that sort of thing and just replace it with, I guess, a more naive appreciation of what it's doing, I think it's probably quite successful. I think that's my suspicion. Maybe people who hate it and for whom the fiddly controls and stuff would be a deal breaker. But it's just that my experience of that has been that people who don't necessarily sort of acquire a particular taste for a particular way that games have to be will adapt to a system a bit more readily, or will be quicker to accept things as the way they are. I think that's maybe one reason why, it came out on PS4 and got a muted response, but the outrage kind of began when it came out on PC, partly for technical reasons, but also because, the PC is traditionally the platform for people who have very, very, very specific demands about how games should be. Literacy, the thing that I think makes No Man's Sky worse for you, is the thing that partly defines the hardcore elements of that community down to is this game secretly up-rendering its UI rather than rendering it natively and all this stuff. And that I'm of the opinion that doesn't matter, but people really care about it. And again, it's another kind of nail in No Man's Sky's coffin.
The last thing that I was just going to say on No Man's Sky was that I actually was considering picking it up on PS4, which might sound a bit weird in light of a lot of the things that I've just said, but I do really think that it could be one of those games that's really fun to play on the sofa with someone, have them kind of go, oh, let's go over there, or oh god, what's that? Can you go over there and check out that weird plant or that weird creature, or that kind of thing where you pass the controller back and forth and you sort of do a bit of exploring, or, one more planet before bed kind of thing.
Yeah.
I can see people maybe sitting down with a kid or, with their partner and actually just having a really nice travel around the galaxy,
It's ripe for updates as well. I could see it being a thing that, in a year I'll go back to and it'll be full of stuff, hopefully, and new stuff. And
base building.
Yeah, maybe. Who knows? And just more kind of prefab things to find. So one of the things the procedural generation has done, conversely, I thought I'd get sick of the procedural generation, but actually it's really highlighted how placeholder the kind of repeated assets are when it comes to the bases that you find and the kind of structures that you find. And it's the very, very kind of copy-paste nature to them really stands out in a world that's procedurally generated and kind of endlessly varied. So it's been interesting to experience that. I think I will get bored of the landscapes eventually. Once that happens, that's probably the end of No Man's Sky for me. But I think it's quite very successful at generating the sense of traveling great distance.
I think it would be really lovely in terms of the shareability thing, is if you could send other people like a moving postcard or something, you know, like maybe if you could generate a GIF that you then tweet at them, or you could, you know, and maybe that they don't like that in the sense that, oh, you're supposed to be on your own and it's nomadic and it's, you know, the vast expanse of space and stuff. But I mean, to be fair, for me, that breaks down because you can see the landscape kind of fizzing into being quite a lot of the time. True. And I don't mind that. It's more that I'm never quite fully immersed when I can see that happening. And so it definitely wouldn't break any of that sense of being alone to be able to just sort of have a social tab and forward someone like, hey, look what I found, or, you know, like send them the encyclopedia entry for like the weird, like I found a dinosaur that looked like it was doing the Thriller dance, you know, like that kind of stuff. I'd love to be, and like there were these weird squid that sort of swarmed and tried to like leave the water and come out onto the beach, like weird washing up gloves that had filled with water and become sentient. And I really want to be able to send that to someone and say, oh my god, look at this.
Yeah, it needs, like, that's the thing, like I was talking about this, like I think one of the simple features that it's missing is like a social feed on that menu, so when you upload a discovery to get points for it, you can maybe choose to also post it with a picture, like, and that would make it's actually one of the few games where the sort of the thing that every Ubisoft game does, where it's like, you've just taken your 80th step, you're one behind your mate who's taken 81 steps, all that stuff would actually fit quite well, because what it sort of needs is not multiplayer, because that's, you know, improbable and wouldn't add much to the experience, I don't think. But what it sort of needs is that sense that all of the people playing it are on this sort of mad collective journey to map out this massive space.
Mm.
And so, you know, even if it just kept track of like how much of the galaxy has been mapped, that would be a kind of amazing thing to know.
Yeah.
Because we were talking about that last night as well, and just sort of the idea of, because maybe that's another reason for PS4 stuff, because it does that shadow play kind of recording in the background thing, so maybe you can just easily ping it up on your Twitter feed or whatever, because I've just been making do with having Fraps running in the background, then recording, you know, a thing, and then like adding in the voiceover and then uploading it to YouTube, and you know, all it's like that. Oh, there must be an easier way.
It just, like, it just needs that stuff and maybe some more polish. Like, this is the thing I find with it, because I can think about all of the things that are wrong with it, from the inventory stuff to even little things. Like, I think if traversal was more fun, minute to minute, the game itself would be, like, a million times better.
Mm.
Like, little things like that. Like, if it had, like, I don't know, jumping or climbing or skiing or anything like that, it's going to be great. But it's weird, because its qualities make that stuff feel unimportant, I think. Like, the reason I'm playing it is not to play an inventory management upgrade Skinner Box game, because I hate those. And I'll do it for a bit in order to just sort of explore more of this, or to give my exploration of this series of worlds purpose. It's something to do, and therefore I don't mind that it's not the best example of that genre, because it's something, because the point of the game is the places.
Yeah.
And it consistently feels like it's consistently exciting to feel like I've finished with one place and I've acquired a bunch of memories on it and named some things and seen some weird stuff. And I spent a bit of time there and I feel like I know it, and to take off and sort of descend towards the next world. And I tend to try and, like, before I finished for the night, and I've done this a couple of times, I'm only playing for a couple of days, but I've always tried to end the night by, like, landing on a new planet and saving there. Because that's a really exciting moment that makes you want to come back. Is like, oh, well, you know, I've just come from this heavily radioactive planet with this amazing green, yellow, blue sunsets. And, you know, deadly, basically, like, armored battle cows that charge you from across the landscape and try and kill you. And I've just landed on this completely desolate planet. Ocean planet, where all of the land is on these massive towering rock spires that stick out of this massive dead sea. And it's like, that's fucking cool. And now I'm going to, you know, I'm excited to load it up and find out what's there for a bit. And then to the next place. And that feeling persists, I think. And only because I've taken it slowly, but also when that feeling kicks in, it's like, if someone was to say to me, yeah, but the inventory's shit,
Yeah.
I'd just be like, well, it's not fucking care. Yeah. It's a weird one, really.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I'm conflicted. But I am enjoying it. Yeah.
Yeah. Some man's sky.
Sky for some, not for others.
No sky for some men. Not all men's sky.
We'll have to come back to it, I think, when we get guests on. I think we should just ask everyone what they think about this game until we've documented everyone's procedurally generated thoughts on No Man's Sky.
It's interesting because I think it maybe asks quite an interesting litmus test for like how you're prone to respond to games, because like I think there's a common thread among like us three and maybe like Andy, I'd put in this category as well, Andy Kelly, of like people who quite like it, who acknowledge the flaws but are kind of a bit more chilled out about it and not really interested in like the kind of sort of chin scratching, but what does this say about the industry stuff?
Yeah.
Because I just don't care.
Tedious, really. Really so tedious. So much of that stuff smacks about, like, the media wants to talk about media.
Yeah.
Media loves talking about media, and they'll attack themselves in order to, you know, talk about, oh, shouldn't we tackle things in a different way?
Yeah. And it's just like, I don't care. Like, there was a great graph someone was tweeting around, while I was out of the country last week. Someone tweeted a graph that's, on the Y axis, on the x-axis is age from like 10 to 40. And on the y-axis is desire to hear cynical men be angry about video games. And it hits its peak at 10 and then continues pretty steadily until you get to about 28 and then drops off a cliff. Yeah. And I can totally 100% relate to that.
Just chill out now and
Yeah, if I don't enjoy it, I'll stop playing it. And if I do enjoy it, I'll keep playing.
That's as complicated as it needs to be sometimes.
Yeah. But and then the flip side to that is obviously this whole like, but is this a consumer rights issue thing? The answer is probably no more so than any other product that I've ever advertised to you. Mm. And, but then there's the sort of the detective Reddit side to it as well, where it's all about like categorizing previous claims and then providing the evidence to their contrary.
And also claims that have been, you know, you can tell from someone's tone of voice and the way they're talking about something that they're sometimes speculating about the game they're trying to make, and they're not making promises about what's actually going to happen. You know, there's so many, like if you take a statement out of context, it can look like a promise when it just wasn't. And if you go back and think, look at a lot of the stuff you said on those chat shows, It was back and forth banter. He was talking about trying to sell the thrill of exploration, not necessarily saying, look, it's going to be exactly this and it's going to have exactly this in it.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's just, you can ruin anything for yourself by doing that. If you could go back through any game, if you enjoy Diablo 3, you can go back through Blizzard's painstakingly public kind of transparent development process for that game and stuff they've put in and then taken out again, and you could just make yourself completely miserable about that game. If you just kind of played it, you'd probably enjoy it and not have all that baggage. And it seems impossible to get away from the baggage No Man's Sky now, but it feels like that to me.
I do think that there's maybe something to be delved into a bit with regard to if you don't explain a game well, like to the point where people are legitimately saying, but what do you do? What even is this? Mm. And you're also saying, but pre-order it. Like, I think that there's an interesting discussion to be had there, because what are they pre-ordering? Like, what is it that you can ever be held to account for at that point, you know?
Mm. Yeah, and then it's the individual's decision to pre-order, isn't it? So, yeah. I mean, just don't pre-order stuff already.
It is, and I do, like, my response to all of those things is to just say don't pre-order, but at the same time it's an industry that is aggressively pushing people towards that, withholding review code, you know, in general, if they know that a game is bad, because they know that people will pre-order, and sort of making it so that people feel like there's a thing that they're actually missing out on. And so I do have sympathy for people who do pre-order things, or who are sort of excited by the things that have been said, and while I, you know, obviously the point overall is still don't pre-order, it's still, you know, like I do see how it happens and why there are problems there that are more complex than don't be a sucker.
Mm. I think caveat emptor applies to an extent, but I mean, it's tricky because it just feels like if everyone chilled out a bit,
Yeah.
It would be fine. Like,
but I feel like that about so many things.
Yeah. Like, I mean, the other side to that though is that if someone is promising you the moon over and over again, more and more aggressively, that doesn't mean they actually have the moon to sell you. And the pushiness, you know, when the question of what kind of game is No Man's Sky, actually the lack of lengthy contiguous game footage or people having sort of played it outside of a really curated experience, that kind of thing. The lack of that should be alarm bells for everybody. And I think that's present in a lot of coverage, but you know, for a player of games that should, like, you know, when someone's offering a vague promise of what a game's going to be, take it as a vague promise and don't put money down. Like, I do think that's, to a degree, that comes back to the consumer, to use a terrible word.
Speaking of people who offer you the moon, I think my sister technically owns part of the moon.
So do I, technically.
Yeah.
My mum got me a parcel of moonland for my birthday once.
Sweet.
I think she went through a phase of, like, those adverts online, you know? Like, she's technically a lady of Sealand, I think, as well. She's bought a title. So Lady Rosemary.
Some people's moon.
She go up there and punch some Kryptonian out of it.
Kryptonite.
Kryptonite.
Punch Superman. Get off the moon, Superman, you'd say, punching him.
Plutonium and kryptonite there into one thing.
He'd just be crying.
Yeah.
He'd be having a terrible time. No moon for Superman.
No moon for Superman, the sequel to No Man's Sky. Coming never. Oh boy. Yeah, it's sort of dominating the conversation. I suppose it'll dominate this part as well, but it is fascinating, and I agree that we should try and use it as a litmus test for future pod guests. Although probably not Alex.
Yeah. I'd have some interesting questions to ask Alex off the air, I think.
Off the air, yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely.
Is this thing muted? Yes!
But yeah, talking about it now and even talking about its problems makes you want to go play it, so.
Yeah, definitely. Something. I think it's a cool thing, actually. Like, I think if it just released out of the blue and you just kind of stumbled across it, it would be like a lovely little thing. And everyone would be really happy about it.
I think everybody would have been as excited as they were at first before they went through that weird roller coaster of I'm excited and now I'm not excited and now I'm concerned and now I'm really excited. Now I'm really, really worried. Now I'm very angry. I'm quite hungry and a bit sleepy. You know, it's like... Yeah.
Consumer rights.
It's like my average Wednesday.
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah, I just love my little corner of the galaxy that I've got now. And it always comes back to me, like, when you go into the discovery menu and you have, like, your list of systems and planets and things on each of those planets, like, I feel like I've actually, like, charted out a little chunk of space. Mm. And that's such a cool feeling. And, like, I come up with planet names by looking at what it kind of, like, what the word reminds me of that it's already called, because they all have, like, a randomly generated name. So the planet I spawned on was called something like Octopedral or something. But it sounded a bit like octopus. So I ended up calling the planet Three Hearts just because octopuses have three hearts. That was just
learned that from Finding Dory.
I did learn that from the documentary Finding Dory. but it's just word association. It's back to the old, you know, like just what sounds interesting in relation to this. Mm. And that's something, it's nothing to do with what the planet looks like, but it's a really evocative phrase for some reason. It's like the old things I used to love about. Like Bungie's writing, actually, is the sort of use of just simple evocative phrases in a sort of sci-fi setting. And, sorry.
No, go ahead.
And what I was going to say is, and then the thing that makes that special on top of it being just me doing this for myself is the fact that I have actually named a little corner of this vast generated space. And the chance that anyone is ever going to edge back out to the edge of the galaxy where I started and find that is infinitesimally small. Hmm. But let's say the game continues to sell reasonably well and survives for a couple of years, at least. It's not impossible. And even though it's, that adds a little bit of something to the experience for me. Like, it's a little bit of magic to it. The idea that even though the game is like 80% trying to think of a name for another fucking reptilian deer, like, it's still like, that was actually my reptilian deer. You know?
Yeah.
I think that's the other alternate name of the game.
My Reptilian Deer.
Well, okay, so I have two questions. One was just, like, what's your favourite animal that you guys have found so far? Because, like, you're clearly looking at them really intensely, but I was wondering for Tom as well. But the other thing that came into my mind while you were saying that was, if you did stick with it for ages, and obviously there are going to be some people who just power through and, you know, sort of head as quickly to the center of the universe as possible. If you start regularly encountering other people's stuff, will that lose the magic of the discovery for you? Because you're clearly naming absolutely everything, and the magic of it for you is someone else might find your stuff.
But I think
what
it would
if
be
you're
amazing
finding
to find someone
other
else's.
People's stuff?
I think if I found someone else's stuff, that would actually be a cool moment, because the chances are very low.
Mm.
And I'm going to head off afterwards. So I'll probably get to a system, but I don't need to name this one.
Mm.
Mm.
And then I head off and I inevitably find another undiscovered system, presumably.
Mm.
Yeah. Favorite animal, Tom?
It's on my starting planet, actually. And it was basically just a griffin from myth, straight up.
A griffin of legend.
A griffin of legend is here. And I think, do you have to unlock a certain type of scanner to name stuff?
Nope.
No, see, this is the other thing. The game doesn't tell you this at all. You hold down the left trigger on the gamepad, or
X,
I don't know.
On the keyboard. So when you go to upload something, it's E to upload it, yeah, and X to name and upload.
Ah, okay, interesting. But I haven't done any of this stuff, really.
So, like, when you scan, you get it, and then when you look in your inventory, then you get to... Yeah, sorry, I was talking about the thing, but, yeah, like, when you go in your inventory, it just has upload or, like, rename. And upload.
Oh, man, I could have named it Griffin. I didn't.
Brian Griffin.
He was cool. Apart from that, lots of variants on T-Rexes.
Mm.
Various sizes. None of them.
Really?
At all. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I've like, many, many variants. Like, on the same planet, I just encountered a crater full of them. Just, like, lots of different species of variations on T-Rex.
I've had lots of crabs. That sounded wrong.
I haven't had a lot of crabs. I think, obviously, because it's an algorithm, I think planets in proximity to each other probably have a greater chance, and then systems in proximity to each other probably have a greater chance of sharing some similar characteristics.
Yeah, maybe so.
And that might affect the diversity of wildlife people encounter.
Yeah, it's interesting that.
Maybe.
Gives a flavour to the system, though. I quite like it.
Yeah.
Mm.
The land of crabs.
Land of crabs, land of griffins.
I found a weird alien butterfly today, which is really cool.
I haven't seen any flying aliens, actually, at all.
Oh, really?
Mm.
Oh, actually, no, that's the thing that I wanted to say, cool, and I'd forgotten. So you get a massive credit bonus if you scan every life form on the planet, or every fauna on the planet. And I had one left that I hadn't found, and it turned out it was just like this flock of bird-like, sort of pterodactyl-esque kind of things. And there seems to be quite a well-known problem, which is that you can't scan things very easily from the ground, and sometimes not at all.
Mm.
And so the workaround for that, if you do want to 100% a planet, is you just have to shoot them until one dies and then scan its corpse. And it's kind of like, if you're playing as like a peaceful explorer, that runs so counter and properly destroys that sort of sense of
sometimes you gotta take a laser to the space, beep pip.
But yeah, like, it's like, oh well, I guess I can just take this on my own terms, and then nope, you have to and you really have to unload on them, otherwise they don't die. So
my recommendation is use the mining laser.
Really?
Yeah, it just sort of lances them gently out
the sky. Because
that
didn't seem to work. I don't know whether they were slightly too far away.
I've got a combat upgraded mining laser. And if
okay.
I got into a big hill, I can easily lance them space bats out of the sky.
I don't think it was working, so I had to bolt gun them to death.
Yeah, that takes a while.
Yeah, a bit sad.
For me, it's just like bounding along, mine some plutonium, mine some gold, laser a little bird, look at it.
Sad face.
My favourite thing that I've encountered was on the last planet. I 100%ed actually, and there's
100%ed.
Two of them. Well, like, you know, got all of the, found all the animals, and that was the planet of the battle cows. It was really weird. The two deadliest things on that planet was a really dinosaur looking deer and the battle cow, and all the terrifying things were completely harmless.
Mm.
Like, there were these massive like bull bear things with these huge hulking forelegs and tiny little back legs. Massive, like, actually massive things, and they were completely docile and friendly. But the best creature on it is, it made me laugh every time I saw it, was it looked like the head of a sandworm, but like really happy. Like a massive grinning head. They're about 3 meters tall. And they look a bit like a bin, because it was this head of a sandworm with a neck stretching back to a single giant foot. like an elephant's foot, that it was like an elephant's leg with a face, basically.
One of my old spore creations.
And then there were two variants on it that had different frills. One of them had like a massive, like Mohican with like little kind of like barb frills coming out either side of its neck and a huge grin on its face. And it was sort of bound along looking really happy. And the other one had like twin ridge frills that looked a bit more businesslike and ran down either side of its head.
Oh, are you talking about those sort of almost like dolly mixture looking things, like jelly top things that blob around and bounce?
No, this is more like most of a snake that jumped around on one foot.
Because I found a little blob that jumps around.
I saw your
and
picture
has...
of the little blob.
No, because I found one that seemed to be related to that one, but this one just has really big eyebrows. I've been taking screenshots. I'll put some later.
But so, and so I called these the fabulous unipede and the glamorous unipede. Because of the whole one foot thing. And there's something really comical about like just climbing over a hilltop and then just seeing these bouncing happy faces in the distance that I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
Just had to leave them behind on their shitty acidic homeworld. But they looked happy to be there, so that's fine. That's probably No Man's Sky, isn't it, really? Until we move on. Should we do questions from questions?
Yes.
Let's do it.
First up, Joseph writes, "Dear Corundum and Khajiit, specifically, dear Pip.
Oh, hello.
Can I have some insect photo advice for my mother, please? And for the rest, what is the best game photography mode?" So it's unclear whether his mother wants to take photos of insects.
Maybe she is an insect.
Or, yeah, in a really Kafka-esque nightmare scenario.
Maybe it's not a nightmare. He seems quite fond, or she seems quite fond. Was it
Joseph?
Yes. Yeah. Well, maybe it is Kafka.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Joseph Kafka writes.
I don't know. I guess, it's really hard to know because it doesn't really sort of seem to address anything specific, but I got a clip-on kind of macro lens for my phone, my smartphone. And I think that it's quite an easy way to sort of start experimenting with that type of photography, because I would assume most people do have smartphones at this point, and, you know, just having a thing that costs about a tenner that you can clip on is a sort of an inexpensive way to start with photography of that nature. And the other thing is the dealing with animals kind of in general, or, you know, skittish life in general, which is that, you know, you should probably try and be sort of quiet and gentle and sort of mindful, I guess, because I think something that I noticed is that as soon as I started paying more attention to insects or actively looking for them, I became aware that so much more was actually going on in my surroundings than I thought before. I think you get used to sort of blanking a lot of it out because it's irrelevant information. And then once you make it relevant, you start seeing things sort of everywhere you go. It makes you a nightmare to go on a walk with because you're just permanently turning over leaves and poking around in thistles, but so I guess it's that sort of thing. And, you know, things tend to fly away or freak out if you cast a shadow over them, you know, that kind of thing.
You're not very good at finding bugs. Never really.
Yeah, I don't know why. Maybe it's because I'm quite near the ground. Got so excited about nettle weevils the first time I found them. And they're like these tiny creatures, like little weevils, basically, if you know what they look like, but they are covered in sort of iridescent-ish kind of bluey green scales, and so they're just these gorgeous kind of turquoise beetles that look almost exotic, and sort of wasn't expecting to see them in the strawberry patch. There they were.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
As for best photography mode in a game, the answer is really clearly Pokemon Snap. Like,
yes,
it is, and I'm not sure how anything.
I really like Shadow of Mordor's photo mode.
Oh, that's a good photo. Yeah,
because your character is permanently screaming, and you'd never ever know unless you activated photo mode and actually looked at his screaming face.
That's more like a free cam for purpose of taking screenshots, though. You don't have a camera.
Yeah, that's a good point. Oh, I really like Beyond Good and Evil. That's a good point. Really cool camera.
I actually, ever since Pokemon Snap and... Well, not ever since Pokemon Snap, but since I had a smartphone and still loved Pokemon Snap, I was really into the idea that it would maybe at some point have an AR mode where you could take photos of Pokemon with your camera. And I'm kind of really annoyed that Pokemon Go wasn't that, you know?
It has that feature, but that's not the game.
But you know what I mean? Like, it was so close to a thing that I'd been banging on about for years, and then it turned up and I didn't want it.
Yeah.
It's like, oh.
Like a shit bus. A person on the internet writes, "Dear crate of cranberry pies, Adam Gontier once intoned, 'It's not too late, it's never too late.' But is that true? After Dota 2's reveal of the artist formerly known as Pitlord, and with the impending release of Legion for World of Warcraft, I'm tempted to return to gaming worlds once roamed. However, I haven't played Dota since its Warcraft 3 incarnation, and the process of relearning its arcane systems means facing a constant clash with prior experiences of an iteration superseded long ago. Meanwhile, any return to Azeroth would mean grappling with 3 expansions worth of missed content, which is a daunting prospect even though it's not necessarily required to actually play through the Legion quests. Do you think an extended absence from a living game such as the above can cross the ludological Rubicon? Thanks for writing that. Have you ever similarly drifted from a game? If so, what gaming ships have sailed for you? Thanks for reading, and thanks for the consistently top-notch pods. You're all wonderful."
Aw.
Yeah. Aw. Hmm. I have a similar, like, I had something from Legion, World of Warcraft Legion, like, quote unquote, spoiled for me. And it's kind of hard to, quote unquote, spoil something that I haven't touched for 10 years and will never go back to. So WoW is definitely a ship that has sailed. But I've increasingly come to realize I feel the same way about Guild Wars 2, that like I missed a couple of years of its living world, ongoing story thing. And while technically I could catch up through YouTube and replaying stuff in the game, I have to be honest with myself, like, I'm not going to. Like, my time shrinks. It doesn't expand. Mm. And that apparently is going to be the pattern. So, accepting the Old Republic is the one that really stands out to me, actually. Because they just finished their big year of, you know, BioWare-style episodic storytelling.
Yeah,
which I really would like to play. I have an expressed fondness for the Star War. And yet...
Really? That's the first I'm hearing about this.
Yeah, exactly. There's only 3 shelves in this room occupied by it, and I'm only wearing a Star Wars t-shirt. Oh, and yet, and I just know I don't have the time. And so, yeah, like, even spaceships have sailed, in my case.
That's sad.
Is it?
No.
How about you guys?
I've left a long road of dead RPGs in my wake, where I've just gone away from them for a week or two, or, you know, a few months, and come back and just completely forgotten what the hell I was thinking when I set up my party and what the hell they're supposed to, you know, how they're supposed to synergize and actually kind of be good at the game. Pillars of Eternity is probably the most, like, biggest example, where a game that I really, really enjoyed and was really getting into the systems. There's no way I can go back to it because I'm not playing the first 20 hours again, but my party is a mystery to me and I have no idea what I was thinking a year ago when I set it up. So I can't just relearn the game when it's in situ like that. And I have had that for many RPGs. Alas. Baldur's Gate 2, Baldur's Gate 1, Planescape Torment, all of them. Oh, well.
Some games too big.
Yeah.
How about you, Pip?
I don't think so, but I think it's because I play things until I'm bored with them or done with them, and then don't feel the urge to go back, so... And I've never been into WoW, and I've never been into, like, any other MMOs for any substantial period of time, I guess. Like, I was into WildStar, but then everybody else kind of stopped, and I didn't really have anyone to play with, so I dropped off with that. And, like, occasionally there are things that crop up and I'm like, that sounds like an interesting thing that you are doing with that game.
Mm.
Or sometimes there'll be things where I leave it quite a while between play sessions. Like, I think I didn't play Overwatch for a few weeks and then went back and, you know, things will always be a bit different, but it's just, oh, okay, fine. And it's, so it's not really a scorched earth policy because there's, you know, nothing sort of actively vindictive about not going back to things, but it's just when I'm done, I'm done. And I also don't think I tend to play the living games so much. I mean, with Dota, it's like I have gone through a kind of not dropping off period in terms of fondness, but definitely in terms of the wish to play. You know, I think that that will probably just either continue to operate on that level and I'll occasionally play and sort of vaguely keep an eye on the meta or massive changes or anything like that. Or it'll just wane and be replaced by something else and that'll be okay too.
Just an endless procession of ships going away at the end of the Great Gatsby.
Well, not really. Just, you know, I'm on a ship for a while and then I cunningly and athletically dodge to the ship that's coming past in the other direction.
Mm. It's like that Destiny raid with those floating arcs.
Oh, yeah. God.
Actually, that's a game that hasn't faded for me.
No, but I was shit at that.
That was brilliant. I missed that. I want to get back into it.
I can't wait for September when the new expansion comes out.
Rise of Iron.
Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of us are going to try and get back in to try and do the yearly achievements.
Oh, yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. we should all do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a great game that is.
We'll talk about that. Yeah. What a great game that is. That we are forbidden from ever talking.
We can do a side podcast. That's precisely what we should do about Destiny.
Yeah, that was the game that triggered the discussion of doing a side Absolutely. Podcast was because it dominated so much of our time for a year because it's fucking great.
It is great.
Evangelos wrote like 4 questions, but there's one I'd like to pick out and answer from his set. And it is, I have been discussing with friends that it is about time that an e-sport gets into the Olympics. This led to a huge conversation about what is a sport and what not. And after a long train of thought, we concluded that current esports give professional players a small career span. Let me explain. A footballer can start playing at 18 or earlier and continue all the way to 30. This leaves him with enough cash to, if he's smart enough to save, retire. In esports, after 25 years, you're basically done. All esports demand very high reflexes and they drop drastically with age. We were wondering if they should come up with a competitive game where reflexes are not as important or create different leagues depending on the age so that the average career of an e-athlete increases, making it more plausible for a career path that might further establish electronic games and sports family. What do you think? And I think the thing that I think about is that I really disagree with the premise of the question. So Dota's player base ranges currently from 16 to 28. And that's includes championship players at both ends of that spectrum. Like international winning players both ends of that spectrum. And that is also the full span of people who are old enough to play the game for a long period of time. Because most Dota pros have been playing for 10 years and they have started when they were 18 or they started when they were 7. And like, that's just, you know, the case basically.
How old the sport is.
Yeah, it's how old the sport is. And from talking to players, particularly players who are on the older end, you don't age out of it really. Because because while reflexes are important, there's a huge amount is based on macro level decision making, and that only gets better as you get older, because you get more experienced, you get more experience with the game, and also you get more capable of making mature decisions under pressure. And so, actually, I think while there are some esports where people do age out, that's true of traditional sports as well, and it's not that different.
I think sometimes people burn out rather than age out. So, for example, you know, you just find that perhaps you reach a point where there's something else that you start to want to do with your life, or even just in a few esports, the scrutiny that you might be under is unpalatable or sort of detrimental at particular points. With regard to the Olympics, they're actually held the e-games, like,
Definitely
week.
Not affiliated with the Olympics, but coincidentally at the same time in the same place.
Which I'm not really going to go into because it just makes me too cross, and I think they should have just used that money and that will to do something in that vein entirely differently. But so it is something that people have clearly like thought about. But I think just because it was mentioned, I do think that the Olympics is kind of problematic for esports because the most exciting esports tournament, certainly that I watched this year, was Dota, and that has an internationally competitive scene. And so pushing people back to competing for a very, very specific region feels counterproductive. Yeah. And also, like, at these other tournaments, people can make a lot of money and get, you know, sponsorship and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And this was really trying to sell people on, oh, for national pride. And it's like, that's one of the things that can actually be really toxic in esports.
And national pride is like a concept from the previous century, and people need to get used to that, I think.
So it just, like, and there might be a different way of doing it, but it certainly felt regressive in the thing. But on the Reflexes side as well, things like Hearthstone, they don't require Reflexes, and that's, you know, a sort of currently a global esport, and one of the ones that you cover on your site.
Yeah.
It's under your remit, so.
And there's other games like Hearthstone has successfully managed to create a genre out of competitive card games, and that has no...
Well, competitive online, I suppose, because Magicka, you probably argue got there first.
Yeah.
Or Magic.
Yeah. It created a computer game genre out of it. I mean. But yeah, no, and I think you're completely right about the national pride thing. I know it sounds probably a bit much to say that national pride is entirely a concept for the previous century, if anything, that annoyed anybody. I mean, it's how I feel. But I think the more specifically, you know, the generation who's growing up with esports now is probably the generation who least in history feels the relevance of nation, with who they make friends with and who they're proud of and so on. And yeah, like, you know,
it's a positive thing as well, I think.
Mm. Yeah, Dota is internationally competitive, and the winning team for this year's international was Chinese, but the second place team was American, Macedonian,
Danish,
not Jordanian, Macedonian. Yeah, anyway, definitely Ukrainian, and who am I forgetting? Someone, but nonetheless, like. You can't pin that down to a nationality. People become fans of the team, not the nations attached to it. And it becomes increasingly difficult to pin anything to it. So the idea of Olympic esports, it's just, I think it's a no-go. I just don't think it's a goer at all.
I think of all of the trying to force esports into a traditional sports template, that's one that I really haven't seen a convincing argument for doing.
No. The only reason to do it is because, and this will sound harsh, it's because the Olympics are something that carries cultural value and that an older generation recognizes as sport. So it attracts a kind of non-endemic sponsorship that esports don't tend to get, or it could. But it's a shitty way of getting that kind of recognition. Esports should be getting non-endemic sponsorship through making, you know, a proper business and governance case for its viability, not by aping, latching onto something that has its own problems.
Like, yeah, and it's completely different in kind of purpose and style, and it's just, they're just different concepts. Yeah, I'm excited about a world in which people get to elect into identities and not simply be born into them. The way that nations decide that you as a British athlete represent these values, or you as a Russian athlete represent these other values.
Yeah.
And you actually get to choose and kind of form relationships and make your own teams.
Mm. Indeed. Sven writes, in the grim darkness of the far future, there is only war and Thurston and almost certainly someone named Tom.
Yeah.
Which he's completely right about.
Yeah, for sure.
Having just listened to Pip's dismissal of Nurgle's name in episode 151, I feel like I should point out that he's based on the Mesopotamian god Nurgle. Or Nergal. This deity seems to have had a varied career, starting out as a general war/pestilence god, to heading up the Mesopotamian underworld, to being designated the head of hell's secret police by 16th century demonologists, to being the embodiment of entropy in the far future.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good Nurgle fact.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
And that is interesting. Legitimately interesting.
Top Nurgle facts.
Mm.
Thanks, Sven.
Could you do Tzeentch next, please?
Where does Tzeentch come from?
No idea. It sounds... I don't know. I don't want to get into this without actually reading where it might have come from. No. I'm going to guess wildly.
Yeah, I don't know. I keep thinking it's from something, but then I realise I absorbed Warhammer lore so early in my life, I'm just thinking of Tzeentch.
Basically history now, yeah.
It's an anagram of Cheez-It.
It is, yeah.
Kind of.
So I keep thinking it's an actual Lovecraft thing, but then I think I'm just getting that from Warhammer.
Yeah.
Or Neil Athetep. Sounds kind of Aztec.
Neil Athetep.
Yeah.
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 Azathoth.
Well, was that the...
No, that's not the question. The question is, veering back into the realm of questions, Warhammer is well served in the digital gaming realm, but is there another body of work or mythos that you would like to appear in a video game form? For example, have you wanted to play some sort of cross between Crusader Kings and Sid Meier's Railroads on the island of Sodor, embodying the bloodline of Sir Topham Hatt, as he brings the Northwestern Railway to prominence and profitability by buying trains named Gordon, Henry, and Thomas? Yes, I'll grant that there are some Thomas the Tank Engine games, but I don't think they tend to be very lore-rich. Or something like King of Dragons Pass, but with the Wombles. A Biggles story done in the style of Meg Giant's Extraordinary Around the World in 80 Days, Shadows of Mordor, but in the Narnian universe. I'd make a suggestion about Holby City to pander to Pip at this point, but I've never seen it. Maybe something like Chroma Squad, where the actors are playing medical professionals instead of spandex heroes and the combos are emotional. Thanks for a tremendous podcast, Svend.
Mm.
Good question.
Is this a good time to reiterate the idea that I really think ITV should get on that massively midsummer, like, basically a Midsummer Murders MMO where you just go around solving, like, well, somebody just needs to mod The Witcher 3 to become Midsummer Murders.
That's an amazing idea.
Well, everybody's gone to the Rapture.
Yeah.
Yeah, just, you already got the nice quaint British town.
It needs to be somewhere between the two, though. I like the idea that you're like a witcher, but instead of a witcher,
you're Barnaby.
You're Barnaby.
Silver pen for beasts.
Yeah, exactly.
Or like
a Miss Marple investigates a witcher game.
Yeah.
That would be fucking amazing.
Yeah.
Silver wig for beasts.
Yeah. And I really would like them to do something with the general environs of Holby.
The Holbyverse. It includes Casualty, doesn't it? The wider Holbyverse.
Casualty and Holby, and they're just gearing up to a 30th anniversary thing this weekend, actually. Because they left it a couple of weeks ago with Connie's car plunging off a cliff. In
God, really not again.
CGI. And then it's just like, oh well. And then there was a super dramatic trailer for this big special episode, which involved Charlie Fairhead, who, yes, is still in it, really slowly dropping a cake. And it was really like doom and gloom and all of that kind of stuff. And so amazing. But also Pat Butcher's going to be in it.
What?
Yeah, I know.
The actual character. Perhaps.
As in Pam St. Clement to be in it.
Oh, okay. I thought the crossover had gone rogue.
God, it's like,
British
soap opera crisis.
Yeah, like Crisis on Infinite Soap Operas.
That would be amazing. And then, like, I don't know, Ian Beale turns up.
The Pat Butcher of every multiverse arrives.
But also
tell everyone
Josh.
Off.
This will mean nothing to our American listeners.
Josh, who was like the paramedic guy whose entire family got blown up in a gas explosion at his house.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I know, right? He left ages ago, but he's coming back for this particular thing. I'm not that excited about that, and I'm really sorry to
it's very detail-oriented.
Ian Bleasdale, who plays Josh. It's more just a kind of like, I kind of get the, I don't know, I want Baz back.
If you had to make a Holbyverse game, what would suit the Holbyverse? Telltale, maybe?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe. Because I was thinking it would be really cool to have an MMO that does that more episodic style of things, which I guess maybe Guild Wars 2 was trying to do with its living world stuff, maybe? Mm.
City of Holbies.
But yeah, so I don't know. Maybe something like that. Or maybe a kind of, one of those awful games that you find on those websites where you have to pick glass out of Elsa from Frozen's foot.
Jesus.
You know, that kind of, yeah. I don't know.
I think for me there's a lot of science fiction settings that I feel are underexplored. There's been a revival in... Like 70s science fiction. No Man's Sky is a good example of that because it's basically a 70s science fiction book cover generator.
Mm-hmm.
But there's sort of interesting sort of half sci-fi, half fantasy stuff like, Jack Vance, authors like that, where there's a sort of, there's maybe room in the world for, I don't know, maybe this is actually happening. Like I was going to say more of like sci-fi games, but with a more substantial sort of fantasy tone, like a mythological tone. Hmm. But Destiny kind of goes a substantial way in that direction, as does some upcoming things like Torment Tides of Numenera, which is a fantasy game, it's also a sci-fi game and so on. So maybe that is happening.
I had some issues with the combat, but Apotheon was an interesting one, certainly in terms of its setting, because it was the art style, it was that game which was like a Greek vase, it was really sort of highly stylistic, but also actually sort of, instead of just invoking for a kind of convenient naming convention, it did actually deal with bits of mythology or with the actual sort of gods in a way that wasn't just sort of, you know, either using them as play characters in the way that maybe Smite does, or, you know, invoking just the Ares or, you know, Artemis or, you know, whatever else.
Yeah.
So I think I'd actually be interested to see more games that explored that side of things. So, yeah.
There was a Rama game. It's a Rama adventure game. It's quite old. But I still think that Rama deserves revisiting in the same way that, like, meeting creatures now in games since Mass Effect and meeting the Krogan, I think, like, there's a games that are able to generate a real magic about encountering a completely new species and interacting with it. I even get that from No Man's Sky, and that's a much more basic kind of rendering of alien forms, but like Rama is all about just finding this floating zoo in space and kind of getting to understand these just whole new concepts about what creatures can be and what language can be. And that would be so amazing to actually go in and experience that in an interactive form. That'd be awesome.
I think I'd like something. I think I would quite like a AAA publisher to take Mills and Boone seriously. And I, you know, that's not in a kind of cheap laugh way. It's because those books are kind of huge and, but it's also interesting in that it's a, like, there are series and timelines and whatever else that you can submit a script for. And like, it's a universe or, you know, a style that has enough parameters that you can lay out and say, stories must conform to these kinds of things. Or, you know, if you write a historical romance, it has to, you know, conform to this level of, I don't know, accuracy or whatever. And so it feels like to me that's a thing where you could go out to indie devs or triple A's and say, you know, what's your iteration on this thing? You know, you could have people like submit loads of different like Mills and Boone style games with different art styles and different sort of storylines and, you know, levels of polish, I guess, but it could still just be really.
So you want them to do with the Mills and Boons license what Games Workshop have done with the Warhammer license?
Essentially, I guess, but I also do think that, because it was the first time, that's why Life is Strange was such a big thing for me, because it was the first time I'd seen media or storytelling that I'd loved as a teenager, you know.
Mm.
That actually appealed to me rather than me kind of doing a best fit kind of thing with what maybe my brother or my male friends were more into, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, you know, that's why I do talk about, oh, maybe a Holby City game or maybe a Mills and Boone game or maybe a Midsummer Murders game. It's because there are these huge, like, blank spots where either people sort of shunt casual games into because, you know, marrying up demographics and things. But, you know, it does mean that there's these big sort of empty bits in the tapestry.
Indeed.
Sorry.
Sorry, I genuinely didn't have a response there.
No, yeah, no, that was my agreeing silence.
Yeah. It's made me think of like Young Adult Fiction and stuff like that. And even stuff like Goosebumps. Like, I remember.
Where's the Animorphs game?
Exactly, yeah.
Maybe there are. Like, I guess maybe Minecraft kind of has to be those things at the moment. So people are sort of have their own servers and their own sort of maybe role playing or, you know, whatever else. But like, I'd be interested to know if anybody has those kind of tweenager kids, like what is actually out there for them? Because there's quite a lot of like just tie in kind of press the button kind of, you know, Ben and Holly or Peppa Pig or, you know, whatever else, like really basic stuff. But
Lego games, I guess.
Yeah, maybe. But like if that's all there is, that's not great.
Skylanders.
But you know what I mean? Like there must be more out there, right?
Oh, kids are just playing Call of Duty, which is the the very likely thing. Stephen writes, after your discussion of Abzu, which, by the way, is also the name of a cracking black metal album by a band called Abzu last week, I got into thinking about how much I love swimming and the underwater in games. However, when Pip mentioned the octopus that you couldn't look at up close, my heart sank, for you see I'm completely phobic when it comes to octopuses, squids, and pretty much anything with tentacles. So much so that I can't stand looking at a drawing of one without going into a blind panic. This means I will never see Finding Dory, the documentary, or play Abzu. But I was wondering if any of you can recommend any deep sea games free, vile cephalopods. More generally, do any of the pod team have any phobias which take certain types of games off the table for them? Thanks for podcasting, everybody. Stephen. I mean, he could take his chances with No Man's Sky, where there is like a chance you simply won't encounter something with tentacles.
But to be fair, on my like eighth planet, I found the hand squid. So
yeah, I found a squid that rolls around in a little Segway.
So yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, it's one of those things where I think when people try to render underwater animals or underwater fauna, they end up, octopus is one of them because it's sufficiently different to other things. You know, you have sort of iconic shell shapes and you have iconic fish shapes that you can use as a sort of variety. And you also have an octopus or a squid and, you know, like rays and things like that. And I think that's a path that certainly artists' sort of minds go down. So I think, I mean, just in terms of games that I've played that deal in the underwater, I think a lot of them contain octopuses, but it might be the case that, because they're actually really hard to animate successfully, so I don't know how much of the phobia is related to how the thing moves. I mean, I know that Stephen said that he finds it hard to even look at a drawing, so maybe this wouldn't help. But, you know, I was thinking maybe the more unlike an octopus something moved, then perhaps that's...
Seems like tentacles are the problem.
Yeah, so I'm just trying to think. Because I don't remember seeing anything with tentacles in Subnautica, and that I don't want to swear to it because I don't want this to be a cruel ending to this story. But actually, like, if you're worried and don't mind spoilers in terms of Discovery, they actually have a Trello board that they use for communicating the early access stuff. And on that board, they have a PDF of like all of the creatures that are currently in the game, and you can actually look at that and see, you know, whether it's safe to go in. I think in terms of my own phobias, like, I can't deal with injections, so BioShock the original is off the table. Can't do it, won't do it.
I was horrified by giant spiders in games when I was like 14 or 15, so there was a bit of Thief 1 that I can get through. There was the Great Wall of China, which was infested by giant spiders in Tomb Raider 2, I think it was. So that was a nightmare. But I battled through and bravely overcome my fear of giant spiders that can never possibly exist. now they're kind of blasé, really. They're such a go-to villain in RPGs now that it's just doesn't even seem like a threat when they turn up.
I really don't like jump scares. I must have said that before. Like, I don't mind horror of most of the kinds, but I don't like jump scares. And the less power, more powerless I feel in the face of a jump scare, the worse it is. Like, if I'm controlling the character, it's fine. But yeah. So for that reason, like, Five Nights at Freddy's is the thing I'm very unlikely to ever play, because it's just jump scares the game, basically.
I tried to get you to play it for me on my behalf, because I'm scared of horror games, so I wouldn't even have it on my PC. But I was having to play it for the work summer games, which I really didn't think through, because I came up with the games list. And so I was trying to get a ringer, i.e. you, to actually play the damn thing for me. And that's when I guess I realized how much jump scares bother you. Because I thought that you were fine with horror, because you were the one that was, like, fine with playing PT.
It's fine with PT. Because there are jump scares in PT, but they're the kind of jump scares I can handle. Because, like, weirdly, because I prefer horror games to horror movies. Like, I don't really like that many horror movies, because I prefer, like, creeping psychological horror to, like, jump scares. I don't really mind. And movies are okay most of the time. This is something specific about Five Nights at Freddy's that I would find annoying, because I can't not jump.
Yeah.
So the kind of repeated stresses of it and the powerlessness, the inability to move or, you know, run away from the thing and all the rest of it. It's knowing that the scare is coming, but not really being able to do very much about it other than click buttons. Like, I used to hate, like, YouTube screamer videos for the same reason, because, like, you know it's going to happen, and it's that moment of just waiting for it to happen that is actually what bothers me. Like, if someone just surprises me in a film, I'm not actually as bothered.
Yeah.
I think there's a very specific type of jump scare I really don't like, clearly, but
I think Adam has referred to it as, like, that Jack in the Box thing, like, where you know that it's winding and you know that it's about to pop, but you just have no sense of exactly when, and it's so stressful.
Yeah. Nick Wheeler writes, did the rest of the body turn up in Bath, or have they found any more feet?
Oh, God, I don't know. Hang on, aren't they technically onto more feet than a normal body would have?
Yeah, it's 3 feet so far.
Yeah.
See, I'm always a bit wary of making jokes about this, as weird as it is, because those feet clearly came from somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's unlikely to be benign.
Yeah.
So...
Well, because as in, that wasn't a glib remark. It was like,
if
there had been two, then there was a chance that I'd missed the story that said, oh, okay, it was because of this thing.
So if you're not aware, this gets Marsh out of it anyway, because the foot disappearing. So basically, people keep finding feet in Bath, just human feet, and no one knows why this keeps happening at all.
It's been 3 now.
Yeah, it's been 3. 2 recently. So who knows?
Yeah.
This would be a side quest in Miss Marple Online.
But no, as far as I know, they haven't solved that particular mystery. So I guess just keeping an eye on the local news, or when people send me the clippings and accuse me of things.
And they've got to accuse somebody, because we used to accuse Marsh. He went to Sweden. At which point the feet thing mysteriously stopped for several months.
But yeah, it's an odd one.
It is an odd one. Finally, Scoo writes, my question, how is TI6? And at his suggestion, and I think this is a really good suggestion, because it would be quite fun to talk about the International briefly, because it was the biggest thing in my gaming life last week. But I also appreciate that whenever we talk about Dota, a lot of people become very cross. Sometimes hyperbolically so, sometimes deeply seriously so. So for that reason, incandescent. So for that reason, we thought we would shunt, at Scoo's excellent suggestion, the Dota talk to the end of the podcast. So if you stop listening now, you don't have to hear it, and you'll only miss out on us saying, like, our Twitter handles.
And I'll get mine wrong anyway.
And possibly some brilliant observational comedy about wizard sport. But that's, you know, you've been warned.
So it's your own fault.
It is.
If you're still
but
here.
But at least we haven't made you skip through half an hour of a podcast or something, because we talk about the forbidden game. The best game. The only game, really. Dota 2. So I was... Pip, you watched online a lot of it. Did you not?
I did.
And I watched in person in Seattle. It was great this year. It was really... Yes, it was it's been interesting. I had my 4 years of TI now, and TI3 was the best in terms of being a fairy tale. The games were great and the arena was nice and intimate and you could meet players more easily and stuff. Then it grew out of that, went to a bigger venue, which didn't suit it for the first year at all. And TI4 was a bit of a disappointment for every reason. The venue wasn't as great. The event wasn't as good. The meta was really bad, very degenerate, and had the worst grand finals that have ever been at TI, with the final game lasting 8 minutes, being very disappointing. And then TI5 was good again. They figured out the venue, found a new way of staging it, so it made sense. And the ending was sort of phenomenal. It had like this big famous moment in the $6 million Echo Slam that rounded out like a really good, close final, good storylines everywhere. And this year was right up there and makes for an interesting sort of case study, because I think Dota is in a curiously healthy place, which is almost a worry, because I think it has only like, surely it can only struggle again after this. Like, I kept thinking this while TI6 was happening, like, God, TI7's going to be awful. Like, we're going to like, this was the new TI3, and so next year's the new TI4. And the reasons for that is, I think, and it sort of made me interesting to think about why, how esports events, the criteria that go into making them work. Because the staging was better than it had been ever, and the production was better, and all the stuff they were doing, crazy stuff like having AR projections of the heroes on the stage itself during the pick ban phase, and all those things. All that stuff was great. But the most impressive thing about it really was the balance. Like, for once, this is the first time I've ever seen an international end and the community not be outraged that there's no patch already to fix whatever problem came out of the international. This is the first international where no one solved the game.
Well,
105 heroes picked or banned out of 110, which is fucking nuts. Amazing. Like, that's crazy. That doesn't happen in any other competitive game. That, like, when you look at the viable pool, it's almost all of them. And even the ones that weren't picked.
How does that measure up to previous years?
It's vastly better. Yeah. Like, I think the average is like 70 to 80.
Sure.
So that's, you know, it's a big deal. That bodes really well for the meta, but also just the international competitiveness. Because if you went off the previous year, and this is the first year that Valve had run majors for Dota, it should have been a European sweep, because all three of the majors were run by a European team.
Mm.
Yet somehow, every favorite team bombed out straight away. The lower bracket, the group stages were a massacre, then the lower bracket was a massacre. And through all this stuff, like, no one team or region seemed to have an advantage. Southeast Asia, a scene that has always struggled at the international, showed up enormously and just started eliminating European teams. The absolute favorites going in, a team called OG, got eliminated by MVP Phoenix, who are a Korean team, and Korea is the underdog in Dota, which is because it's the bizarro esport where Korea is the team, and that's because Korea plays StarCraft and League of Legends.
Right.
And then they hit a stack of 4 Filipino players and 1 American that everyone was expecting just to go out. Like, when people were planning their Dota compendium predictions the week before, it was like, put all your guesses for like fewest heroes picked and most deaths in a game on TNC, because they're going out in the first round.
Yeah.
And they had a phenomenal run, ended up top 8, eliminated the favorites on their way up. 2-0. Like,
was this, that everyone was kind of scouted the way European teams played and came with counters, or?
Europe is the sort of, it's more like, it's always tricky to pin down regional meta in that way. I think maybe possibly, I think it's more like, I think there's a little bit of that. I think, The type of Dota that was being, I think the teams that were doing well going into the event were probably the slowest to adapt to some new things that came out at the event in terms of strategy and stuff, because they probably didn't feel like they had to change to some degree. Yeah. Maybe lack of preparation as well. Don't know. But what that kind of highlighted was that, like, and this is a really cool thing to have to say about an esport, it genuinely is in a place where, like, anyone can win it, which sounds like such a platitude the rest of the time. But, you know, the grand final was between a team called Wings, who admittedly were amazing and had a very good year and had come close to doing very well in a lot of other tournaments and had a very good group stage and are phenomenally talented. But they're also complete unknowns and formed their team in August last year.
Right.
So, like, they've had a year to get people's, like, get their name out there, but no one knows who the fuck they are. And their Chinese team, they came through and ended up winning the whole thing.
Wow.
But their opponents in the grand final were a team called DC, which is almost a better story, who are made up of rejects from other top teams.
Amazing.
So earlier in the year, there was a big roster drama and a big team called Team Secret kicked two of its players. And there were rejects from, a collapse of some of, some Eastern European teams. And essentially a team started as a sort of a bit of a gamble by a Dota YouTube channel runner. Basically came in to bail out these players because they were on Twitter 6 months ago saying, anyone need a guy? I've been kicked out of my team and rosters are about to lock again. They get picked up for this sort of weird international team of, like I said earlier, like, you know, a Macedonian, an American, a Ukrainian, a Danish guy. And who am I forgetting? Anyway, so apologies to the one member of DC who apparently I'm completely blanking on. Where's we from? Jordan. I think it is Jordan. And they come through, defeat all the people who pointedly knock out half the people who they were kicked out of and end up in the grand final from fucking nowhere.
Amazing.
And that's such a good, like, ended up screaming this at the time, and apologies to anyone who followed me on Twitter last week who didn't block the TI6 tag. But it was Rocky where every single person was Rocky. Which is sort of impossible in some ways. It is impossible. It's like, why, how come everyone be the underdog? But it's still great.
Was the quality of the Dota up to standard or better than usual, or kind of, how did it feel in terms of clutch plays and general skill?
Well, Pip, I think you pointed out that there were two games that were genuinely amazing. Yeah.
There was EGE Home Game 1, which was just one of those absolutely ridiculous, like, it looks like it's all over and then somehow the side that because I don't want to spoil it in case somebody hasn't seen all of the results and does genuinely want to check that out. There's a comeback that just is amazing over the course of the game and just really sort of nail biting and tense, and it has those moments that where esports is kind of at its best when you're like, holy shit, I didn't know a human being could do that in this game, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know that was a possible thing. How is this not over? Kind of thing.
That game was actually record breaking in terms of it was a degree of comeback that has never occurred in Pro Dota.
Wow.
Over, you know, tens of thousands of games over a decade. Like, it has never happened. So that happening on a world stage is fucking cool, rather than in, like, the bottom end of a Star Ladder League somewhere.
Yeah.
It occurs to me that I have basically just spoiled that game by even just
The fact that it's a comeback story is like, you look at the team that's losing.
Yeah. And the other one.
Well, how it happens is still spectacular.
Yeah, it's so worth watching. And then there were just like some really good moments in other bits. I mean, James Archer did our recaps and sort of picks out particular things. Like, there's an amazing Invoker game at one point. And, so if you check out, I don't know the address for yours, but if you check out the International 2016 tag on RPS.
Yeah, and it's just the International tag on PC Gamer.
Yeah, and so there's all kinds of stuff like that. I really loved a moment where a guy from Innocence, a guy called Innocence, or Y, on the side that eventually won the whole thing, towards the end of their upper bracket final, puts a guy who is about to die inside a kind of demon dimension ball to keep him safe at the very last moment. It then opens up, spits out him on tiny health, and then two replicas. And the sort of the confusion and all of the other stuff and the time that it's bought actually lets him not only get away and survive, but then do a pivotal thing later in that fight that ultimately, I think, wins them the game. And it's things like that that you just watch and you're like, holy crap, like, how are you playing the same game as I'm playing?
Like, there's some absolutely, like, one thing that's really interesting is
the lower bracket finals.
The lower bracket finals between EG and DC.
That felt more like a final if you were going by the TI3 model, where, like, you know, the sort of the underdogs and the super emotional celebration at the end of it, and it just being one of those heart-stopping, amazing, oh my god, I think they're going to do this kind of things. So in a weird way, the grand final felt like it suffered off the back of it just a tiny bit, because it was like, but we've already had our fairy story.
Yeah. And they, you know, and then some of the other cool things about it, and there's a lot of things I love about Pro Dota at the moment. The reason I think the game has a really, really healthy future based on this year is one of the other things is that, even though this might be suggested by the amount of heroes that were picked, it still felt quite experimental right up towards the end. And specifically, there were two teams that were willing, that looked like they were having fun, basically. There's a lot of teams for whom it looks like work. And with, when it's a $20 million prize pool, of course it looks like work. And the two teams that looked like they were having fun for the whole tournament were DC and Wings. Mm. So that it was those two ended up in the final was a big deal. Like, one of the best moments is, second game of the lower bracket final, EG versus DC, best of three. DC is not favored in that matchup because EG and DC are scrim partners. EG is the favored North American team and they won it last year.
Mm.
And EG, as I say, they're scrim partners, and EG wins that matchup. DC wins the first game, and then in the second game, so one game up in a best of three, at this point there are 104 heroes picked out of the pool, and it looks like it's going to stay that way. The bottom six, is that's a big number anyway.
Yeah.
It's fine. And there is a fucking edge of an edge of an edge strat in North America that involves running one of the unpicked heroes, Jakiro, as a mid laner. He's traditionally a support. Some people will build a push strat around putting him mid to get him lots of levels. That's the sort of the top level of it. And like, it is a thing. It is a thing, but not really. And you're not going to pull it when you're one game away from the like $9 million grand finals of a tournament.
Mm.
And DC picked it as their last hero. Mostly as a joke, because the panel had made a running joke about the fact that Jakiro is never going to get picked. And there's a brilliant moment where you can see the booth camera and, a guy called Rasmus Phillips in Misery, who's the captain of DC, kind of like is like laughing to himself as he picks it. And then the team is like, way! And then the referee behind them is like, way! And it's like, dude, guys, like surely, like everyone else looks deadly fucking serious. Mm. And these guys are in a booth, like on the stage in front of, you know, however many hundreds of thousands of people online, just going like, we'll have a lol game. We'll do a lol game.
Amazing.
It's like, don't do a lol game because you'll lose. And they did. And then they had to like pull it back in the third game, but like they were one win from doing it. They could either ride their momentum into a second game that they could win, take the series 2-0, or they could just go like, way!
The crowd went crackers.
Yeah, it went fucking berserk. That's awesome. And that's kind of why they did it. Like afterwards in the interview, Misery said, like, it's like, did you pick it apart to get a car response? She's like, yes. But Wings did exactly the same thing in the final, the like, first game of the final. Like they keep picking out Pudge like it's going to work, and it never fucking does. Mm. And like, you know, all the games they lost in the entire upper bracket was because they picked Pudge, and they kept doing it.
Mm.
And that spirit, I think, is really nice. When other teams were getting further away from that and would drift away from their own styles towards a few picks that were dominant.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the fact that you have people that are still almost enjoying it as a game at the top level is super nice to see as well. Yeah, so, yeah, I've got nothing but good things to say about it. Like,
yeah, I mean, I have a few, like, so they're sort of small things, and they're mostly just things that, like, if you were doing a post-mortem of the event, like, as the organisers, you would say, okay, next year we need to focus on this, this, and this. But on the whole, the technical side of things went really well. Like, last year we had bits where, like, the host and panellists were having to fill for, like, hour or more because, you know, there'd been a
DDoS attack
and you know, all of that kind of stuff. And but this year they had, you know, it was almost seamless. I think I only saw like a couple of pauses, and yeah, like the meta being so varied. I think Winter said, he's one of the analysts, was just like, there is no meta. And the actual presentation of the event was really good as well, like not just in terms of the staging and things, but in terms of the fact that they seemed to be having fun, but were also that they had organized it really well and had given real thought to how they would present match analysis and things like that, which was that was really nice actually as well. I mean, Yeah.
One of the things that was really nice about it, which I might write something about after the fact, is so like, if you weren't aware of the controversy that was under the Shanghai Major, a major so bad it's been deleted. There'll be two majors next year. The Shanghai Major was a disaster for a number of really bad technical reasons, and a lot the company that was initially brought in to run it fucked it up, and then another company was brought in to salvage it, and there were so many terrible moments, like them doing the big introduction thing where the lights go up on the player booths at the start, but all the players had shown up.
Oh, yeah, so I saw that video.
Like 10 minutes of lights going up on empty booths. Yeah. And then to delays and problems and broadcast problems and all sorts. But the controversy arose from Gabe Newell personally sacking a panel host that they were using for that event. And calling him an ass on Reddit, which is like the dumbest thing Gabe Newell could have ever done. Like in terms of, I don't disagree with the sacking, but it's there's professional ways to announce things, yeah, and that wasn't it. And what that led to, and essentially the guy was sacked for off-color jokes, and basically he's a good panel host actually, but he just made a few really shitty, unnecessary jokes about like Chinese porn and stuff. And it's like, dude, come on, realize where you are. But this led to, obviously, because internet hysteria works the way it does, this led to a sort of widespread idea that like Valve were determined to suck the humor out of Dota coverage, and that it wasn't allowed to be funny, that it had to be a golf tournament, that it wasn't allowed to be silly. And it wasn't that, and they could say it's not allowed to be silly, but they've also they don't communicate, and also that was the impression people got. Okay. And but this year they actually did it really well. Like there were some really weird bits that you can see the hand of a guy called Bruno Carlucci in, because he's a former panel host that used to wear very loud suits and then went to work for Valve and is on this doing some of this event stuff. Mm. And he has a really good sense of humor. But there was a moment where it cut back after a game and all of the panelists were Muppets.
Wow.
Just actual Muppets. Like well modeled and puppeteered Muppets of the people who were on the panel when you last looked.
It reminded me of that Nintendo Direct.
It was. Yeah. And they made no reference to the fact that this had happened. And like everyone in the arena was like, oh God, like the acid just kicked in. Like, and they had the analysts under the desks, like looking at little screens with next to a puppeteer playing them. And it turns out Valve actually have someone who works at Valve who worked on Fraggle Rock.
Well.
And so they were like, we need a Muppeteer. Okay.
Like, got one of those.
I loved
on.
Fraggle Rock.
Yeah, exactly. Like we'll just use our on-hand Jim Henson Creature Workshop Amazing. Person.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so they just replaced all the panelists with puppets for a bit. And they kept doing this, like, cause Valve do have a really good dry sense of humor that comes out in a lot of their stuff. And it was nice to see that come out in the event. One of the other things was, there was a new segment where, a guy who'll be familiar to anyone who tried to learn Dota called Purge would present a play from the game on a touchscreen TV that was next to him. Mm. So he'd pick out a play and they gave him this new technology, which is a sort of a precursor to, I think, some new replay tech that's being added to the game.
Nice.
Where he'd say, like, this moment, this is why it's important. And they gave him a touchscreen so he could draw lines on it and, like, zoom in on stuff. And it was really good. And people would hand over to him and then he'd, like, hand back and be like, thanks, Purge, which has become a running joke in the community for ages. But it, because of the format with the panel on one side and then panning over to Purge on his big screen, it really, he looked like a weatherman and there was no getting around it. And it became this running joke that, like, and now here's Purge with the weather, even though he'd be showing a replay. And so at the beginning of, I think, the fourth day or the fifth day, the host, Paul Cialona, said, and here's Purge with the weather. And it cut over and he actually just gave a weather forecast out of nowhere, just told you the weather that's for awesome. The northern United States. And apparently all of the maps of the US have copyright on them, so they couldn't put them on the broadcast.
Right.
So Bruno from Valve had to draw a map of the US basically from memory use on their weather forecast.
That's amazing.
And it was just, it's just stuff like that was like...
He also did a kind of play-by-play of two of the panelists, Shiva and Shane, taking down a sign that was sort of there to kind of bait Reddit. And, and so Purge was like talking you through this play-by-play of those guys just like running in and sort of stealth stealing the sign. And yeah, that was, it's really nice to sort of see a kind of an actual show don't tell living the thing of, just because we got rid of this guy doesn't mean that we don't want fun on this thing. It means that he really was not appropriate for that thing. And we really should never have, have set that situation in motion. So yeah, this was really nice actually. I mean, you know, there are things that I'd say about, you know, it'd be nice to have more diversity on the panels and things like that. But
one thing that was a shame was that they brought a female commentator for the first time, Android, and she's really good, but she only got to do group stages and didn't get to do the main event.
Yeah.
And I know she was at the main event because I saw her around, but like that seemed like a shame because there aren't enough women in that community as it is. And, you know, there is a presence at least in someone like Shiva, but the fact that they brought in a commentator just for the group stage it would have been nice to see her get a main stage game.
Mm.
The other thing I thought was very interesting about it being there, maybe I was more aware of this than you would be online. But I think you'd be aware of it online if you had Twitch chat or Reddit open next to the stream. But, and you know, saying about how the way Valve handled humor was in tension with how the community itself handles humor. Because I hate Twitch chat and I really hate memes, to be honest. And they flirt with it a bit, but for the most part, the panel stuff is a lot more mature and the humor is a lot funnier and more mature. One thing that was really apparent was that culture surrounding the game does make its way into the live event in forms of the signs that people hold up in the audience and stuff. And like two guys got thrown out for having a really racist sign and stuff like that. But it was like specifically a problem among like young dudes who were there, and you got like a notepad in your gift pack when you arrived, and they would write stuff on it and try and sit on the seats behind the casters, so when the camera would point at them, they could hold up a sign and have it be on stream.
Yeah.
And they would play to Reddit in a big way and stuff like that, and play to Twitch.
See, I preferred the guy who was sat behind the casters and had one of the Tidehunter backpacks and was pretending to make it eat another man in front of his head.
There was some funny
stuff. And watching him gradually realise that that was what was happening behind him. That was pretty good.
There was some genuinely funny stuff, and there was some like good moments with the crowd as well. But there was like, there was a funny atmosphere in the room sometimes. Something I've not really experienced at other TIs. Like it felt rowdier. And it made me aware that like it's very, very blokey and very.
I saw a lot of people, maybe just on Twitter, like people who were involved with the event, using words like "triggered" in a kind of
so
sarky kind of internet-y.
I ended up saying this to some people there that the only kind of meme-y, internet-y, reddity words that kept getting used by the panel were "triggered" and "cancer," which are the two that I'd like them to get rid of, because otherwise they did a good job. It's not that. It's like, so the environment was very like, it felt like frat house kind of jocks was like a big part of the audience.
Oh, really?
And like, and I mean, like, cause I mean, I've been to, you know, esports events everywhere in the world, and that's something that's quite specific to the American audience because it's quite specific to America. Like that particular form of young masculinity, which is all about like board shorts and a backwards cap and being a bit of a dick. I mean, obviously I'm not saying that young American men are the only young men in the world who are a dick. It's just that there are specific genres of it, and there's a specific one in the UK as well. And I'd never seen it, for example, at any of the events I've gone to in Germany, really at all. Actually, there was one, like one spectacularly drunk guy at the Frankfurt Major, but that was like one dude. Whereas as time went on, like the audience would get rowdy in particular ways, and the signs would get more aggressive, and it felt a bit like Twitch chat live in some ways. Yeah. Like it was definitely not an environment where I'd feel comfortable talking about, for example, ethics and games journalism. and the other thing.
Oh, I was sorry, just going to say a couple of years ago, because there were like families and stuff, there was a guy there with his tiny baby with like tiny ear defenders on and stuff, and it felt like it was far more an atmosphere where you could bring a family, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I saw there were kids there this year. It felt very full. Like there was a much bigger Chinese contingent as well, and that was kind of cool because they were there to sort of really cheer for the Chinese team, so that was nice to see. There was less USA this year, but only just, and probably because the USAing didn't bear out for EG.
Yeah.
But there was something about it, and I don't know whether the bar did better traffic this year. The whooping was one of the things that stemmed from that. Like, it ruined one of the streams. Basically, some drunk guy at the back, as far as I can tell, started whooping. Like, really loud, piercing whoop.
and it got imitated by other people in the crowd and became a genuine problem that the cast had to beg people to stop doing because it wasn't actually that bad in person, but on the live broadcast it was really bad.
Yeah.
And but there was a sort of there was a belligerence where it was like, well, no, fuck you, if you don't want us to do it, we're going to do it anyway. And eventually people did pipe down, but that was the only side of it that I suppose was negative, is I've not really felt that tension between Valve and its audience, which is one of the top, I've written about that so many times because I think it's fascinating that Valve have this community that's occasionally terrible that they don't want to regulate and they have the best game in the world, but the community is often awful. Like, I'd never seen that in real life before. TI always felt like the moment where you reconcile those things. Whereas this year was the TI where I was like, actually, some people who like this game are pricks.
I wonder whether part of that is it's such a long main event and the days are so long that if you're in a dark room and you've started drinking because why not? You're there to have fun and you've been drinking for 9 hours.
Yeah.
And you've lost track of time. You're there with your mates. You're egging each other on. Like, maybe there's an element of that to it where if you had things that were maybe a 4-hour thing in an afternoon or an evening, it wouldn't be quite the same. I mean, people will still get loaded because football matches
have
people getting loaded, but
it felt more like a cultural atmosphere than a particular inebriation thing, though. Mm. I don't know. I can't hugely back it up, but just there was a slightly different atmosphere to it this year.
Mm. Fair enough. It's interesting.
But that's pretty much all my dote takes.
Mm.
Yeah, I'll put links in the show notes to the coverage on RPS and PC Gamer if people are interested in highlights and stuff. And that's all the pod we've got pod for.
Mm.
If you would like to send us a question for a future episode, Pip, you look sad.
Oh, sorry.
You sad about the end of the pod?
Well, no, it was more that I was thinking maybe I should use my follow us on Twitter for someone better. You know?
Oh, sweetie.
No, like, not like that, but like, you know, an actual, you know, a force for good or something that isn't me, you know? Something that is cool. Like my friend Maya, maybe.
Huh. Oh, well, we'll find out when we get to that bit. If you'd like to send us a question on Twitter, you can do so. We're at Creighton Crowbar. You can also email us at questions@creightoncrowbar.com or leave a question on the forum at creightoncrowbar.com/forum. You can join in the chat. The hot chat in your area on our Discord channel, which you can find a link to in the show notes or on the sidebar of the website at creightoncrowbar.com. Finally, you can follow us as individuals or our cooler, better friends. I am at C Thurston, that's CTHURSTEN, and my cooler, better friend who posts lots of cool pictures is Philippa War, which is at PHILIPPAWARR.
Nicely played.
And I did spell that faster than you can.
Yeah, no, you did. I don't even know if it was right. Tuned out partway through.
That's the problem. Tune out halfway through your own name.
I know. That's why I shorten it to Pip. It's just a lot easier. I'm going to recommend you follow my friend Maya, who is an ex-colleague and good friend from Digital Spy, and he is at Maya Nissim, which is MAYERNISSIM.
Cool.
He's really nice and really smart and writes interesting things.
Cool. I'm at PC Ludo, L-U-T-O, I'm not sure. Can't talk today. At PCG Ludo, L-U-D-O. We're not even drinking this pod
no.
as well.
Yeah, that's why.
That's probably it.
We're off our game.
Yeah.
Reality hasn't had its traditional course correction.
We'll bring back the booze next week, probably.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Cheers. I've never got the hang of that.